Speeches and interviews on Acts of Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program starts out with Julia Anglin, talks about the many ways that the government, private businesses, and criminals can and do collect our private data. Julia shows that because of the pervasiveness of the surveillance system we live in today, we are in danger of becoming a society that self-censors itself instead of demanding our rights. Julia Anglin is an investigative journalist for ProPublica. She was previously a staff reporter for the Wall Street Journal and was part of the journal's team that was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in 2003 for their coverage of corporate corruption. And then after that, a study in the journal Science quantifies a direct link between higher temperatures and increased conflict, ranging from domestic violence to civil war. One of the lead researchers, Edward McGuell from UC Berkeley, tells Steve Curwood that as worldwide temperatures increase with climate disruptions, he expects to see more strife.
My friends, ladies and gentlemen, out of all the topics that I'm privileged to discuss here at the Great National Constitution Center, there is none that I'm more excited about than privacy, and there is no author that I've been more looking forward to meeting in person and talking with than Julia Anglin. We are fellow soldiers in the privacy trenches for many years as journalists. We've both written about privacy, and there is no reporter in America from whom I've learned more than Julia. Your path-breaking reports in the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere about the tangible harms of online tracking, and especially the details about how much precisely is being collected and what is being done with it, are unparalleled. You were a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2012 because of your incredible Wall Street Journal series on this subject, which revealed for the first time something that many of us hadn't known, which is that, among other harms, people are actually charged different prices online based on the profiles that faceless algorithms create about us without our knowledge or consent. Let me just finally, to introduce Julia properly, note some of her other many great achievements. She is currently a journalist at the wonderful and independent news organization ProPublica. She was a reporter at the Wall Street Journal from 2000 to 2013 and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2011. She was on a team of reporters that won the Pulitzer in 2003 in explanatory reporting for coverage of corporate corruption. She's also the author of Stealing MySpace, The Battle to Control the Most Popular Website in America. We are so thrilled, I am so thrilled, to have Julia here to discuss her latest book, Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. Welcome, Julia Eglin.
Thank you.
We have so much to discuss. I'm going to start with the obvious opening question. What surprised you most about how much companies and the government know about you?
Well, thanks for having me here. I'm a huge fan of your work as well, and a great introduction. Thank you. In my book, Dragnet Nation, I decided to take the privacy investigations I'd done at the Wall Street Journal a step further by investigating myself. Right? What is known about me, and what can I protect? And so I sought my data from as many places as I could find, which actually was very few places. So, for instance, I identified 200 data brokers out there, but only a dozen would let me see my files because there's no law requiring them to. But interestingly, even in that small set of files, it was shocking how wrong some of them were and how right some of them were. So some companies were completely wrong about me. One company said I had never completed college, I was a single mother, and I had a very poverty level income. And that none of those things happened to be true. Other files were incredibly detailed and had every address I had ever lived at, going back to the number on my dorm room in college, which I had actually forgotten. and every member of my family perfectly associated to me, and all sorts of purchases that I had made, including ones I had made fairly recently. So on the whole, they knew a lot about me. And occasionally, they knew all sorts of wrong things about me, and I couldn't decide which one actually outraged me more.
Were you surprised by how much Google knew? It was the depth and precision of your searches that surprised me and actually freaked me out a little bit.
So my Google search history was incredibly shocking to me. So since I joined Gmail in 2006, they had been storing all my searches, and that's a long time. And when I started to look at my searches, I realized how revealing they were. They were far more revealing than my addresses, because it was a map of every single day. I would wake up in the morning and I would Google the weather, and then I would Google, you know, something about something with my kid's school, was it open? Then I would look at what article I was researching that topic. Then I would start weirdly shopping for online kids' clothing. And you could just see my mind making its little leaps, and the idea that there was a record of the mental madness that goes on really disturbed me, and I quit using Google search after that.
We'll talk about the alternatives and how you cope with them, but there was more that struck me. You got your TSA records and found that the description of why you were going abroad for a reporting trip was actually reported to private companies and then turned over to the government.
Yeah, this was shocking. So I went to the Customs and Border Patrol and I said, give me the record of my border crossing. So it's one of the few sets of files that you can obtain from the government fairly easily, if easily means waiting 3 months and writing letters. right, with that, that's a relative standard, right? So it was incredibly comprehensive. And what I learned from it was that the Wall Street Journal, where I was working, used a travel agency which used a system that basically automatically sent some of the internal communications that I had with my boss. I had to fill out a little online form about why was I traveling, etc., and my boss would approve it, and that's how my travel would get approved. And just by the virtue of sort of like no one paying any attention, all those communications were swept into the government files. And so when I brought this to the Wall Street Journal, they understandably flipped out, because, you know, advanced knowledge of where reporters are going about what story is something probably they don't want the government to have. So they actually stopped working with that travel agency for a period of time until they got it fixed. But it took quite a bit of time. And this is one of the many problems of this data age that we live in right now, is people don't even know where the data is going. If I had asked the Wall Street Journal where is the data, they would say, oh, it's secure, it's right here, and they didn't know.
The amount of inaccuracies, the glitches, it seemed very hard to get a sense of control and a handle on just how much was out there.
Yeah, it was very difficult to get a handle on it, and I'm sure I don't have a handle on it. I've probably seen some very thin layer at the top of what's really known about me. Because, as I said before, most companies don't have to share it. Or even if they do share it, for instance, Facebook let me download an archive of what they had on me. But we know, actually, from a European who obtained a fuller set of his data from Facebook under stricter European privacy laws, that what I saw was less than what they have. Because his file, it had everyone who he had deleted as friends. It had posts that he had deleted. So it actually kind of kept this ghostly records of things that he thought were gone, whereas the one I saw was a more sanitized version.
Okay, well, we're going to discuss in a little bit the steps you took to protect your privacy, but before we do that, I want to talk through with you a question that both of us get all the time. Whenever you speak about privacy, people say, what's the harm? Nothing to hide, nothing to fear. I'm not doing anything wrong. Why should I care if Google knows my search results? And the great virtue, one of the many great virtues of this book, is that you enumerate those harms with great specificity and you give us specific examples of people who were harmed in different ways. Let's start with government surveillance.
Okay.
And you talk a lot about Edward Snowden and the PRISM program and the fact that the government is collecting the metadata, that is the telephone numbers that we dial and so forth and the duration of the calls, as well as intercepting the content of some conversations. I'm not a terrorist. Why should I care? What's the harm?
Right. So this is the most common question.
usually I get it. I'm sorry. But it was a pleasure for me to be able to ask you that question.
Right.
Why are you so upset about privacy? Aren't you? You must be a terrorist yourself, aren't
that's
you?
Right. That's right. Yeah, exactly.
So what's the harm?
It's interesting, first of all, that we even have this harm conversation, because it's worth noting that in Europe, there's no need to justify this. Privacy is considered a human right, and it's just a given. You don't have to have this conversation. Putting that aside, though, this is the U.S. We want to debate this conversation. So let's debate it. The thing that I think is the biggest harm from government surveillance, actually, is that it leads us to be less free with our speech. So I read about this guy in my book who was surveilled by the FBI. He and his friend, they're both teenage young men in Santa Clara, and his friend had written a kind of sassy post on a social network called Reddit. And he had basically said, I don't know why the TSA is so crazy at airports. You know, I could just go to a mall and bomb it, no problem, right? Which is actually true, but, you know, maybe unwise to say, but he said it. So a couple weeks later, this guy and his friend were at the car shop getting an oil change, and the friend, Yasser, saw that there was something under his car. It was a tracking device. And the FBI had put this on his car to surveil him, and he later found out that it was because of his friend's comment. So this is already kind of a disturbing story, but what I found really disturbing was what happened afterwards. So after they found out they were being surveilled by the FBI, their friendship fell apart. The author didn't want to be friends with a guy who might put him in danger, right? He became incredibly circumspect in his actions, and he doesn't feel free to talk about aggressive, and he is Muslim, American, and he now uses a different name, Aladdin, because he feels like it's less Muslim, and he's still detained every time he comes across international borders, and he doesn't feel like he has the same sort of free speech rights that I feel like is a central part of our country.
You argue so powerfully in that chapter that it's not just privacy, but free speech that's at stake, that at the core of what the framers were concerned about was enough practical obscurity to be able to engage in political dissent, and yet, as you say, the Supreme Court has not been sympathetic to claims that mass surveillance violates free speech.
No, the Supreme Court has not, and there are a number of reasons why they've taken that path, but largely it's been over this issue of standing, which is that you can't prove you're surveilled, and so that you can't show any harm. You know, we have an interesting case coming up, which is now after Snowden. People can prove that they were surveilled, and so it'll be interesting to see whether the Supreme Court revisits that. But one thing that I talked about in that chapter, I called it freedom of association, because actually, even more than speech, I was concerned about association, because Yasser was afraid to associate with his friend anymore. And what big data is really a way to build associations, right? People who collect big data say the thing that they love about it is you suddenly realize that people who buy felt pads to put under their furniture are better credit risks. And you would never have seen that in any other data because it was too small, as they say. And so it builds associations. But we do have a history of protecting freedom of association, right? The NAACP versus Alabama case, where Alabama wanted the list of members of the NAACP, and the Supreme Court upheld the right to keep that list private. Now, the thing is, those lists are no longer private because you don't have to join the Young Muslim Men of Santa Clara anymore. Yasser was automatically entered into that by the digital trail that he left behind.
Hi, I'm Steve Lerman. I'm the guy that produces, edits, narrates, and promotes great speeches and interviews. I'm the guy responsible for airing in-depth interviews, speeches, and even debates on controversial subjects such as war and peace and climate change and the economy. I hope you like listening to it as much as I like producing it. Access Sacramento broadcasts it on the internet every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. And you can find the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com as well as at Facebook.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. You don't know what life is really worth. Is that all that Peter is told? After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Sky. Take away everything and make everybody feel high. But if you know what life is worth, you would look for yours on earth. And now you see the light, you stand up for your right. Yeah.
Get up, stand up.
Jump, jump.
Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up.
Get up, stand up.
Don't give up the fight.
Life.
Sick and tired of your ism, schism, game, dine and go to heaven in the Jesus' name, Lord. We know and we understand, Almighty God is a living man. You can fool some people sometimes, but you can't fool all the people all the time. So now we see the light,
what you gonna
we gonna
do?
Stand up for
yeah,
our
right. Yeah,
so
yeah.
You better get
up, stand up,
in the
don't
morning.
Give it up,
stand up for your right.
And now back to Julia Angwin and the Dragnet Nation.
In addition to those great First Amendment concerns, you also identify Fourth Amendment concerns, and you actually went to the former East Germany and found out what the Stasi knew about its citizens. How much more or less did the Stasi know than Google knows about you?
Right. Well, so the Stasi, if they really wanted you, there were a couple people on whom they had dozens of binders. They measured their surveillance in binders, right? So some people had like 30 binders, 50 binders. But I looked at average files, which were 20 to 50 pages long, handwritten. I got them translated by Stasi experts. And they were not as robust as what I was a typical Facebook profile, even. Because nowadays, the Facebook timeline dates back several years, and you can see quite a bit about someone. Now, that's not to say that they didn't know how to be repressive. They were far more repressive a government, and you know, I always want to be cautious with this, which is that we are better at surveillance, but not as good at repression, and I think that we want to make sure we keep it that way.
It's a good balance, believe me. Does it work? You tell the story of Zazi, who I guess is one of the people who the government has offered as an example of someone who is caught through this PRISM surveillance, and yet it's not clear that the surveillance itself was the cause of it and that he might not have been caught without it.
Yeah, the Zazi case is the one that the government uses most often to defend the NSA's bulk surveillance programs ever since the Snowden revelations. And Zazi was a guy who wanted to blow up the subways in New York City. And they did identify him because he had written an email to somebody in overseas who was a known terrorist. And they did catch that through the PRISM program. Now, the thing is, though, you don't need a bulk surveillance program to monitor communications to known terrorists. We actually have a process for that. It's called get a secret warrant to monitor the communications of terrorists. And so that was their tip. But basically, they caught him by literally chasing him across the country in cars. He was driving from Denver to New York, and they had like a team of agents trailing him. It was incredibly old school.
Now, the GPS device that Yasser was followed by was a form of search that the Supreme Court later struck down in the Jones case and said that you're not allowed to put a GPS device on the bottom of a car and track people's movements 24/7 for a month. What about the future of Fourth Amendment issues? You talk about fascinating cell phone tracking cases. You say it's currently open whether or not the government is allowed, now that they can no longer put a GPS device on the bottom of my car, they can just subpoena the geolocational information stored by AT&T or Verizon or whatever it is.
Right.
And some folks in Congress are saying you need a warrant for that. The government is pushing back.
Right.
What will the courts do? What should
so
they
have
do?
The problem we have with the Fourth Amendment and these devices.
Yeah, it's for timing now, not to track your
Right, but they are the best tracking device ever devised, right? We keep them next to our beds. I mean, like, any spy would love their target to carry such a thing.
Yeah.
So the problem is the Fourth Amendment, the way the court has interpreted it has been very much about the boundaries of your actual home. So the Fourth Amendment protects the papers and effects in your home, and so the interpretation has been that if you give your information to somebody outside the home, a third party, such as the phone company or a bank, you have a lesser expectation of privacy in those records. And so that allows the government to get your cell phone records with less of a legal standard. And that is known as the third party doctrine. In the Jones case that you referenced, Justice Sotomayor suggested that it might be time to reconsider that in a world where we basically store all of our papers in third-party servers. But that hasn't yet been opened up by the court.
This is a law professor's question. I'm only asking because I don't know the answer and I'm interested in it. What is the best alternative to the third-party doctrine? In other words, so Justice Sotomayor says, we have a problem. In a world where the Supreme Court said, if I take data and store it in a database held by a third party, I have no expectation of privacy in it. That means none of us have any privacy. But she didn't say what the court should do as an alternative.
Well, I mean, I don't know that I know the answer, but I think it's worth pointing out that all of the tech companies, from AT&T to Google to Facebook, are lobbying to get that particular part of the law changed. They want the search warrant to be the standard for cell phone location records, email, really sensitive data that currently, because of the third-party doctrine, is easier for the government to get.
So as you say, Congress could pass a bill saying you need a warrant to get access to this information,
yes.
And that would help things.
Yes, it would.
What time is it? Are we too late? Damn, I think we can catch it at 11 a.m. The skew we are accustomed to is quite a sight to see. I hope they show those bombs with the cameras. I hope they show some buildings falling. The smoke and flames that fill the screens really, really do it for me. Quick, run. Let's go home and watch the war. What fun. Let's stay at home and watch the war. Well, the planes come flying in. watch the war.
Oh man, remember that dude on the bridge? That bridge?
Absolutely.
It looks
like a video game.
How about that time in the air shaft?
Oh man, that's
some bad. Who's gonna play the hard ass general? Who's gonna play the national hero? Who's gonna play the competent commander? Sending in the troops. Who's gonna be the hairy reporter? Who's gonna play the weeping mother? Who's gonna be the network on the ground? Getting all the scoops. Quick, run.
Man, I hope sports cops in this war. It was so fun.
Let's go home and watch the war. What fun. Let's stay at home and watch the war. Once I believed in the power of many. Once I believed in an American band. Tight in gloves, covered in velvet. First young masses who will take a stand. My belief turned to doubt in the blink of an eye. Doubt turned to sorrow as my poor eyes see. Sorrow turned to anger as I listen closely to the jackboot truth up on my TV.
Is that my jersey? Oh man, check this out. Here it comes.
Oh man, gotta hurt.
Would you mind grabbing me a beer in there? Man, you need a bigger TV.
What? Enough of something completely different.